From Austin Film Festival and PRI, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process from today's leading writers and filmmakers. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. On this week's On Story, we'll speak with the writers behind Mad Men, Westworld, and 11/22/63 to explore audiences' fascination with film and television set in the past.
I would say that for me, I'm not drawn to material particularly because if it's of a time, I loved this story. And I felt like I understood why this story needed to be in the past.
We'll also hear from some of today's top romantic comedy writers on the lasting influence of filmmaker Nora Ephron.
If anything is like too happy, it's unrealistic. But if anything's too sad, that's also just unpleasant, and who wants that? And a lot of the stuff that we've seen here that she was doing was like, even the happiest things have this undercurrent of bittersweet.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI, we'll be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. From Lawrence of Arabia to The Crown, audiences have always been intrigued by stories set in the past. But what considerations do writers have to make when telling a story in a different time? And what liberties can they take when they're writing about real events or real people? Screenwriter Alvaro Rodriguez spoke with 11/22/63 creator Bridget Carpenter and Mad Men writer Carly Rae to discuss research, authenticity, and the dangers of nostalgia. Clips of 11/22/63, courtesy of Warner Brothers Entertainment. Clips of Mad Men, courtesy of Lionsgate Television and American Movie Classics.
The first thing to lead with is, who are the people in that world, in that era that you're telling a story about, and what in their humanity and their day-to-day experiences am I going to be able to relate to? I think that you can watch Mad Men and realize that you're not just watching an experience that's cased in glass and has nothing to do with working in a workplace in 2018.
For 11/22/63, which was a very particular adaptation, so I would say that for me, the end was part of the story of the protagonist, Jake, was about finding a portal back to time and falling in love with the past. So I also, in reading the book, fell in love with the story and so wanted to, my way in a sort of visual and visceral way was, well, what are the things about the past, almost in an opposite way, that are different from now that you would experience an explosion of love and being there? And it also had to be, with that, grounded. So unlike, say, The Fabulous Mrs. Maisel, that show now, which if you turn it on, the style and the production design of it, it just looks like a beautiful advertisement. It's a bandbox. It's exquisite looking. 11/22/63, my cinematographer and director, Kevin McDonald, and I wanted to create a world that was of the past that was like documentary. So I was like, I want to feel like you're in 1960. So we have to spray dust on the cars, not have a bunch of shiny, gorgeous cars, which everybody in production wants to do because they look so amazing. And I said, we have to have people who actually wear clothes more than once. We have to have fashions that are not of 1960, but maybe they bought it in 1958 and they're wearing it now. So we approached it with a really particular eye to both documentary, but something that would be visually, we wanted beautiful, cinematic naturalism. That's what we were going for.
Did that have any effect, or, you know, what's the relationship of the visual to the story, to the script, to the details that are in the dialogue or in the scenes themselves?
Well, I would say probably the most explosive, meaningful place in that story, having to do with both what the story was, is not only does Jake go into the past, he goes into the past with the express goal of preventing the assassination of John F. Kennedy. So we ended up recreating the day of the assassination in Dealey Plaza. We shot Dealey Plaza. We had 600 extras in vintage clothes. We had the presidential motorcade. We did research into what cars would be in what order. Our costumer, Roland Sanchez, took the Zapruder film of the assassination of JFK, blew up film stills, and meticulously recreated 50 costumes from those film stills. We recreated every, we went, let's, that's the story. The story is we're stepping into an actual thing of the past. And the other thing that we did that was, I mean, just thrilling as a storyteller and daunting and made me feel like allegiance, because this is something that happened in many of our, not in my lifetime, but in my parents' lifetime. There are people who are alive that remember this. And so we had permission from the rights holders of the Zapruder film if we wanted to reuse that film within our storytelling. What we also did was shoot our own Zapruder film. So we used that camera and we shot what happened, and that is the footage that we ended up using in our storytelling. So the kind of meticulous recreation felt, again, really in, bound into the storytelling of that story, again, because you're leading up inexorably to an event that was a real event, but we are utterly fictionalizing another ending to that event. So it was kind of like, be original and have great fidelity to the design of that.
Yeah. Sharpshooter.
Werner Herzog talks about the difference between the accountant's truth, which he says is kind of that, the detail that is super specific, that is an enumeration of things. Does that strike you as something that you, you know, consciously or unconsciously sort of try to do in your work?
Yeah, I am writing a feature film about incarcerated firefighters. And you can go and do research and meet the people and find out how it actually works. And so much of it is harrowing and fascinating and intricate. And then you have to decide what the story you want to tell in your movie. And there will be moments that you have to simply choose a creative license approach to make the story function. And it's been a lesson in choosing the ways that you're going to tell the truth that are actually going to be served by a handful of carefully selected, respectful, fictional details. Fictional, and so oftentimes it's just an elision of things. You know, it's like, well, the process actually takes these 10 steps and these 6 months, but for this to tell the story or the truth of one woman's experience, you kind of need that process to happen a little more quickly or a little bit more off of what the documentary facts would be. But it's challenging, I think, to look at the facts and at first have a really insistent desire to get it right. And then at the end of the day, realize, like, you've got to get it as right as you can, and don't be disrespectful to the experience of the people who were there by telling lies about it, but you do have to tell the story and prize the story most at the end of the day.
Yeah. What I can speak to about that is, I would describe myself as a deeply curious and ultimately lazy researcher, which is, I'll read everything. I read books on, I mean, with the JFK assassination, there's no shortage of material. Let me just clue you into that. So I read the diaries of Lee Harvey Oswald. I read Dallas, 1963. I looked at the photographs of Time Life of the Kennedy. You know, like I dove in. It's fascinating. And as a sidebar, I can tell you, I went into both the project and having read the book going, I don't believe in conspiracies, and now I do believe in conspiracies. So that changed me. It was exciting. But that didn't become part of the story of the book. That just was a fun change. So I read everything, and then I throw it all away, and I tell the story. That's how I would boil it down. I inform myself, and I try not to get bogged down. And try to like have joy and fun and let it inspire and push you forward and never let it become a speed bump.
That's right. Yeah. Don't bend the story so far to reach some accurate detail that you've lost the point. But there is something wonderful in doing the research first if you can learn to step away from it and go and tell your story.
I can say that, like, walking around the grassy knoll, which I did before writing that scene, informed the scene. It was thrilling and fun, but I didn't let it stop me and go, that never could happen because. Right. I just gave it more life for me. I hope it comes out on the screen. Yeah. And that's, I think, all you can hope for.
Is there another element where you feel a responsibility to the events, to the people, and how do you balance the responsibility to the people involved, you know, telling the right, you know, telling it in the right way and that honors the people involved versus sort of being more, taking more creative license?
It's a tricky one. I feel like you want to take an honest approach to what you're doing, and you want to take it seriously, particularly if you're writing about people who are still here and alive and active and will be able to engage with the story. That feels like you have an extra level of responsibility to get that story right, which is not to say to please those people.
Right.
Or to hide truth to make them look better. It's not a PR piece for people who are, you know, who are living if you are telling their story. I think you have a duty to not misrepresent anything fundamental. But I think it is a dance then to decide if you are gonna have to take creative license here or there about how certain event, what the order of certain events was. You just have to approach with caution and respect for the people that you're writing about, and kind of still the goal of telling the greater truth, remaining in service of the greater truth about the people you're writing about.
Yeah, well said.
You will always hear, period is hard. Mm-hmm. That's the quote, period is hard. Oh, that would be great, but period is hard. And then when you start to point out all of the period shows that either have worked or are currently working, I mean, to say period is hard in a moment with, you know, The Crown, and you know, I think what they mean it typically is period is expensive. Period right. can be yeah. expensive, so it better be really compelling if we're going to go down the road with a period piece. But I think if it's compelling, then don't let the fact that it's period stop you, because obviously we as an industry make compelling period material every year.
What do you think is the draw? Why are people still interested in these stories, in historical things or in period things? Is it a kind of nostalgia for a different time, a different place, and being able to inhabit that space?
I'm wary of nostalgia. I love emotion, and I even love melodrama, but I don't love nostalgia.
Right.
And in fact, we talked about that a great deal in terms of our design. I would say that for me, I'm not drawn to material, particularly because if it's of a time, I loved this story, and I felt like I understood why this story needed to be in the past and what a character was searching for. So it was, for me, just fulfilling that drive. I think you're right to bring up nostalgia, because I think it's sort of a, I don't know, it's an axe. There's something that's...
Yeah, I have a...
We all want to say that it's much easier. It's so, time was so simple then. I'm like, right,
yeah, no,
before civil rights, yeah. It was so simple. There's yeah. a mistake, like, so I am really reluctant to go, like, what a simpler, more beautiful time. Yeah. I think that's up.
Yes.
That's up.
It's
Come
a very,
on.
That's a very, nostalgia is very toxic in yeah. that regard, because it's very, yeah, it erases a lot of,
right.
a lot of life and a lot of complexity.
On Story is a part of a growing number of programs in Austin Film Festival's On Story project, including the On Story PBS series, the On Story radio program and podcast, and the On Story book series. To find out more about On Story and Austin Film Festival, visit onstory.tv or austinfilmfestival.com. On Story from Austin Film Festival and Public Radio International will be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We've been hearing from writers Bridget Carpenter and Carly Rae on what goes into writing a story set in the past. Both Carpenter and Rae worked on the HBO series Westworld, which takes place in a science fiction amusement park set in the Wild West. Rae also wrote for Netflix's Mindhunter, which follows the early days of criminal profiling at the FBI, set in 1977. Clips of Westworld, courtesy of Home Box Office, Warner Brothers Television, and Bad Robot.
Was there any particular episode or scene or something in Mad Men that made you felt the most either challenged by or connected to that dealt with something that would have been specific to a past moment?
There was one wonderful moment towards the end where Peggy is moving into a beautiful apartment that has beautiful ceilings and hardwood floors, and she has these crappy drop ceiling tiles installed, like that, you know, to lower the ceiling. And it was such a nice moment of like, this is the stuff that if you watch HGTV and people are going to houses and they're like ripping out all this crap that people put in the 60s, it's like, oh no, but this is a character who was like, no, this is the trend. This is great. Let's get these drop ceilings in, which I appreciated. It's like, they don't all have gorgeous mid-century furniture. Some of them are, you know, have a different aesthetic. But yeah, I mean, in terms of looking at those stories and being there while they were being written and feeling connected. I mean, the magic, I think, of Mad Men was to make it feel almost like you're watching a beautiful piece of art, but you're also connecting to the characters on a number of levels. And I mean, I was a staff writer on that show, and so connected very simply to Peggy, who starts her first day in the pilot, and you can see her already grating against the order that's being laid out for her. And I always really appreciated, like, I related to Peggy without having anything actually in common with her.
So how many trains did it take you? Only one, but I got up very early. In a couple of years, with the right moves, you'll be in the city with the rest of us. Of course, if you really make the right moves, you'll be out in the country and you won't be going to work at all. You'll be here just across the aisle from me. We'll both take care of Mr. Draper for the time being. I don't know what your goals are, but don't overdo it with the perfume. Keep a fifth of something in your desk. Mr. Draper drinks rye. Also, invest in some aspirin, band-aids, and a needle and thread. Rye's Canadian, right? You better find out. He may act like he wants a secretary, but most of the time they're looking for something between a mother and a waitress.
In the early episodes of season one, you're watching the women actually represent a spectrum of points of view. And so it's, instead of it just being this monolithic, like, oh, the secretarial pool is one thing and then the housewife is one thing, I really connected to and appreciated that there are moments where you understand Joan's hostility or Joan's, you know, sexuality or Joan's desires, Joan's orientation to power, and then Peggy's orientation to power. And so those were things, you know, as a young person who was trying to build a career in the entertainment industry, I really connected to and appreciated that there was, I don't know, such a multiplicity of angles on that experience represented in this one show in an era that I was before I was born.
Did you have a similar experience on either 11, 22, 63 or one of the other projects where there was a challenge relating directly to sort of the historicity or the period quality of the material, but you had already had a strong connection to it, or there was a challenge involved with telling that part?
I think I stole my attitude from something that I heard Francis Ford Coppola say. And he was talking about making The Godfather, and he said, whenever, I'm going to mangle his quote, certainly. So he said something, whenever he was unsure about how to stage a scene, he would go back to the theme, what he felt in his heart, what the theme was, and he would go, oh, I'm just going to do the theme. And I felt really strongly about writing this, you know, piece that ended up being, it was had a beginning, middle, and an end, that anytime I felt lost or I wasn't sure, I didn't immediately see a path in terms of the historicity and getting that particular bit right, I would remember that the story is about an ordinary man in the time that I'm from who wanted to make a difference. That was kind of my own beacon. And so then it was, things became easy and clear, and the what we were going to show of the past became very clear with that, and where we needed to end became clear, because I knew that whatever beats of the story we would keep or leave. This was a story that was about, I deeply, deeply care about making a difference, which incidentally, I want to do. So that's meaningful. And he thinks he's going to go back to the past and make a difference because he's going to save Kennedy. And surprise, it is not that that makes a difference in his world. I'll let you watch the show and find out what the... But so that's kind of how it was for me. It was just knowing the heart.
Let's talk about Westworld a little bit. Talk about some of the challenges of what I would call sort of inventive history.
I will say one of the things that we always defaulted back to, I was on season two, so this was inherited wisdom from season one, but one of the lenses that we really had to apply, particularly in the designing of the Ghost Nation. So, you know, Ghost Nation was a kind of a background player in season one. We wanted to bring them forward in season two, and we were kind of ramping up to an episode that would be all in Ghost Nation. And so we had to sit around and talk about, okay, well, how did Ford approach designing these guys? We're not designing these guys. We have a character who is the designer of these characters. He's a white British, you know, elderly man who had fantasies of the American West. So you kind of have to come through that lens first. Instead of like, okay, would he have tried to be meticulously accurate? Sure. Is he going to change things because he has a zest for putting on a show? Absolutely. So what are those fudged details going to look like? What fudged details would this 80-year-old British white man, you know, make? And in a certain degree, there was an interesting, like, well, would they have been the most respectful depictions of Native Americans if the point of them in this park is to be game fodder?
Yeah. Savages.
Yeah, they're the savages. You can go play those narratives. So it was a really interesting, tricky dance to say, okay, we're working inside an American historic paradigm, but it's being recreated through a specific lens in a theme park for a specific reason. So you kind of invent a hybrid of the textural details, getting the textural details correct, and then inventing a little bit of razzle-dazzle that's coming from one particular impresario.
My primary drive was to maintain the honor of my tribe. I gave myself a new drive to spread the truth. What truth is that? That there isn't one world, but many, and that we live in the wrong one. This will help them find the door.
I will say that just about Westworld in general, created by Lisa Joy and Jonah Nolan, is by far the most intellectual show that I had ever worked on. Mm-hmm. So for season one, which I came in late to, so I could take very little credit, I'll take no credit. It was just a pleasure to be around all of these brilliant people putting this together. I felt like the questions that they were asking and the writer's room were posing were not so much about the past, but about consciousness. And it was about what is the birth of consciousness, what is the birth of humanity. So the past, honestly, from my point of view, was incidental. The past was all in the design. The design was taken care of that. The questions that were kind of actively struggled with on a writing level were about consciousness and what that meant, and therefore character, so consciousness and characters.
Do you struggle with the sort of meta qualities of this sort of interlacing of stuff as a writer? Is that something you embrace?
The head is a big place where it started.
That's
and
right.
And then it found heart and soul, and I found that really fascinating. I found it fascinating.
Yeah, it really is. It's
it's
interesting to think about the conversation about the past in the context of Westworld. It becomes...
It's a fake past.
It's a fake past, yeah. But it becomes a conversation about how memory functions.
Yes.
For each individual character, what it means to be remembering the past, mm-hmm. having that come into their presence, that it's in fact the remembering, the ability to remember the past is very tied into the awakening of their consciousness. Like having access to their memories is what makes them come into full consciousness, essentially, or coming into full consciousness gives them full access to their memories.
How do you balance a kind of emotional truth of a story and a truth of an antagonist, but maybe wanting to make an antagonist more villainous than they really perhaps were in real life? what can you live with? Truly. Yeah. Truly, what can you live with? And I would say, of course, the assassination of John F. Kennedy is something that affected this entire nation. Many people, again, who are alive. And I was thinking, his daughter is alive. Now, you know, and also, that's not entirely what my story is about, but it has a, so what, for me, it was just, what can you live with? What can you go, I'm going to stand behind this. I'm going to stand up and say, I did the best I could, and this is what I believe, and this is how I'm ready to do it, and have some lawyers. Mm-hmm. Because I think that that's right. You know, I think you want to feel honorable about it in your heart.
Sleepless in Seattle, When Harry Met Sally, You've Got Mail, Julie and Julia. It's undeniable that Nora Ephron was one of the greatest romantic comedy writer-directors Hollywood has ever seen. Professor Greg Garrett spoke with Man Up writer Tess Morris and 500 Days of Summer writer Scott Neustadter to discuss how Ephron's films continue to entertain audiences and how her writing has influenced their own work. Clips of When Harry Met Sally, courtesy of Castle Rock Entertainment.
I think the first thing that I'd like to ask is, where is that personal connection for you all? What is it about Nora Ephron's writing, about her work, that has been, you know, in some way formational for you, or that made you want to be here today?
So I saw, my first exposure was When Harry Met Sally. I was 11 or 12, and I remember, I might get verklempt talking about it, but I walked out of there and I was like, that's my And I was a kid, and all my friends were into escapist Star Wars-y movies and all the Spielberg stuff and action, adventure, and I was not. And I realized what I liked was these personal stories, the just real people, movies that I could relate to and not the escapist things that everyone else was into. It was Dead Poets Society, and it was this movie, and I was like, well, that's me. That's what I want to do.
Another well-known rom-com, Dead Poets. Is
that? Yeah. Well, in it, there's that one arc, the Knox Overstreet arc, which is amazing. Anyway, that really sort of began my where my voice was going to be, and I owe a lot to this movie and to her writing for that. So,
I actually didn't see any Nora Ephron movies until a little. I saw Silkwood when I was quite young with my mum, but obviously I think I was quite young when I saw that. Mm-hmm. So I actually didn't see When Harry Met Sally when it came out. Until I saw it when I was in my late teens, early 20s. And I like to think that I've sort of grown old with Nora Ephron on some levels, because I came to her a little later in life and then had that exact feeling of like, oh, this is my this is what I've been trying to like aspire to and write to for a long time. And I think what she did so brilliantly was she managed to make everything personal but universal, which is the ultimate thing to be as a writer. So I think once I realized, like you, like, oh, I can, this is the stuff that people want to actually write about and are interested in, and I don't have to, you know, and it's, I was watching a lot of John Hughes movies in my sort of, when Harry Met Sally came out. So I look back now and think, I think whenever you find her, that's your moment. It's like, that's your cute meet with her. She's also the ultimate, you know, it's Mark Twain, isn't it, who says humor is tragedy plus time. Mm-hmm. And Nora Ephron is the ultimate person of taking things that are happening to her and then turning them in, taking horrible, terrible things that have happened to her.
Nora worked in the Newsweek mailroom, and it was not by choice. She worked in the Newsweek mailroom because even though she was college educated and a brilliant writer, it was not possible for women to write for Newsweek at that time. And so she worked very early and on late into a period in which women are not often represented in great parts, not often represented as filmmakers and writers. And one of the things that I ran across in preparing for this that really struck me is perhaps important for us as we think about storytelling, is that she said, I try to write parts for women that are as complicated and interesting as women actually are. So I'm wondering if there are some women characters that we're going to look at today that sort of stand out for you as sort of exemplary, and if her writing about women has helped to shape some of the women that you've created.
Well, the first time I saw When Harry Met Sally, and I thought, I saw Sally Albright and finally felt like, oh, that there I am. Great. There's like a slightly neurotic, kind of annoying, but you know, she's genuine with it all. And I think obviously there's been a slight kind of strange trajectory from that character. But like, I also like love Katharine Hepburn. Whenever I see anything with Katharine Hepburn in, I think, oh yeah, she's like another person that I on screen really responded to. And I think that what Nora did so well was she always had a central axiom in her movies. She was always posing a question, you know, and obviously we all know when How I Met Sally, can men and women be friends? But from that, every single female character had an opinion, you know? They all had, in any scene, she's always coming, you know that there's something behind everything that they are talking about. So I think she was able to write women as people, and that's really, I think, the best way to write women, because we are also people. End scene.
And so the first thing that we've got is a clip of older couples talking. And so, Scott, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about why you wanted to start with this or to include this. And
well, I find this very interesting. I think when I was 11 or 12 and I saw it, I thought they pulled people off the street. And it felt very documentary and real. Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, obviously it's not. When you get the script and you read the script, she wrote all these things.
We fell in love in high school.
Yeah, we were high school sweethearts.
But then after our junior year, his parents moved away.
But I never forgot her.
You never forgot me.
No, her face was burned on my brain. And it was 34 years later that I was walking down Broadway and I saw her come out of Toffin Eddie's.
And we both looked at each other and it was just as though not a single day had gone by.
She was just as beautiful as she was at 16.
He was just the same. He looked exactly the same.
I mean, anyone who follows me on social media will know my obsession and my friendship with Billy Murnett, who wrote a book called Writing the Romantic Comedy. But what he says, which I always really love, is that when you meet two people, a couple, who have something interesting going on, mm-hmm. he always says, ask them how they met. Because that's what a romantic comedy kind of is. Because, you know, it's the courtship. So these two people have a whole movie in them as well that came before and comes afterwards. And I think, like, I love hearing people's stories of how they met. So this opening sequence is a dream to me because they're clearly based on real stories as well. And I think it's very smart and clever to do it in slight sort of snapshots as well, because then you also know what this movie's going to be about now. And that's also very clever. Subtly, she's saying, here's how all these people met. Now we're going to watch a movie about how two other people met. So it's thematic, it's subtextual, it's all the things that you need, and also fundamentally very, very funny.
And their story is so simple, right? There's no drama. That's
that little
marry,
squeeze
and they got married
at the end is like, do I want to stay?
And then, and you know, and so it, the trajectory is you're now going to see something that's not simple.
Exactly.
And if you think back to these guys, you are watching this realizing, I bet their story wasn't that simple either.
Yeah,
I
totally.
Bet you they've got a whole movie in them as well.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's like...
She probably saw him across the room and thought, I am never marrying
right.
that man.
Right. And I think also the other thing that it does is they don't look like movie star actors. They're, that's you, that's me, it's your parents, it's your grandparents, it's literally everyone.
Oh, I wish that was my parents. They are great.
So, but doesn't that set you off on this, like, you're going to watch something and you're going to relate to it.
Yeah.
These are you. And at the end, when it's Harry and Sally and they're telling their story...
Well, that's the ultimate payoff as
it's
well.
It's amazing.
You go, oh, that's why they were there at the beginning.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and Public Radio International. We'll be back in a moment.
We'll be right back.
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back with Man Up writer Tess Morris and Spectacular Now writer Scott Neustadter. They spoke with Professor Greg Garrett to discuss how writer-director Nora Ephron mastered and elevated the romantic comedy genre. Clips of Silkwood, courtesy of American Broadcast Companies, Inc. Clips of Sleepless in Seattle, courtesy of TriStar Pictures, Inc. Clips of Julie and Julia, courtesy of Columbia Pictures Industries, Inc.
You know, we're talking about beginnings here. And, you know, one of the things that is at least a convention of the romantic comedy is what Tess was talking about. How did you meet? And so the sort of, you know, cinematic way of talking about it is the meet cute, you know. What I'd like to do is I'd like to take a look at the piece from Sleepless in Seattle where the son gets the father on the phone with the talk show host and is, you know, sort of talking to her about what they've been going through, and then and Meg Ryan is in her car listening to it. And it's a classic meet cute, although it's not, because, you know, obviously they're not even on the same side of the continent.
Maggie... my wife, she really did it. She loved it. She made everything beautiful. And it's just tough this time of year. I mean, any kid needs a mother.
Could it be that you need someone just as much as Jonah does?
Yes.
Do you all remember this scene? Is there anything you want
to... Yes. Yeah. I mean, the Sleepless in Seattle template, by the way, is crazy. It's a rom-com about two people that don't meet until the end of the movie. So it's a big risk. And I believe that while she was directing it towards the end, she thought, are we actually going to get away with this? Are people going to watch an hour and a half of two people not meeting? So this is a cute meet that is a virtual cute meet, you know?
Yeah.
So that's why it's an interesting scene, I think. Watching it again, actually, just reminds you what a great director she was as well. So... structurally, obviously, they're having their cute meet on screen, but not together. And she does that very simply as well, by, you know, that feeling of, like, when they say, yeah, you do it at the same time, there's the Bing moment of, like, oh, we said the same thing at the same time. That means we're destined to be together. Very common assumption. But what I think, watching it again, you realise also the choices she makes in direction also really contribute to the structural payoffs in it, because... they are both on the phone. Like, someone else might have just written that scene. He hands the phone to his son, and then he can't hear. But because they're both listening and they're both aware, they are forced to be much more honest than they might have been otherwise. So she's giving us a lot of information there. She's saying to us, this man... and she's managing to make bereavement funny, you know, which is also a real skill. It's the ultimate way of introducing two characters and giving us all the information. She's a romantic, he's a cynic. It's the usual classic sort of setup. And, like, later on they go on to, you know, they both peel the apple in the scene, you know, all the different things. And Meg Ryan's character is with someone at this point as well. So there's all of that going on.
All right, so we're going to jump a little bit ahead into film structure, and we've got a scene from Silkwood that we're going to take a look at. And this is the scene from early-ish in the film, where we have the contamination in the nuclear plant. And, like, it's super scary. And one of the reasons that I picked this one is it sort of stands in some ways in contrast to a lot of the things that we think we know about Nora Ephron, because this is a really powerful and dramatic film.
Saw Thelma this morning.
Thelma hadn't had her mind on her work since her daughter took sick.
Yeah, you know, it's terrible what they do when they scrub a person.
I've been through it. It ain't so bad.
Did she have just external, or was it internal?
Just external, they said.
Well, did they give her a nasal smear? That's how they tell about the internal.
No, I don't think so.
Shoot, I knew that. Why didn't I think of that? They should have given her a nasal smear.
Well, you can't think of everything.
Oh, they didn't even give her a nasal smear.
Why are you so interested?
This was the movie that kind of, like, she'd written some other stuff before, but this was the sort of thing that pushed her into the next level of writing, which is, you know, and it's a great example of a movie, like Scott said, that is about something very serious but infused with human emotion.
The moments that they spend in this movie are often in a disaster movie. You would not see those. They would be rushed through. They wouldn't exist. But this is all about the human part of the crisis and the catastrophe, and that's what she does so perfectly, which is these women and just those scenes of them dealing are so much more interesting and dramatic than the danger and the terror that's going on around them.
So usually in Hollywood today, when we see a disaster film, it's like one of these Michael Bay things. You know, and it's like things are crashing into the Empire State Building, and it's the end of Avengers, you know, and 100,000 people just got killed by a collapsing space whale or something. But, like, we don't know anything about those people, and it's all about the spectacle. But here's a story about the end of the world where we've got human casualties, and that's what the story is all about.
Personally, whenever I rewatch that movie, I am always really struck by the fact that she is such an unapologetic female character. She is kind of unlikable many times during the movie, and she sort of kind of takes no prisoners and really is, it's from her point of view pretty much the entire time. And when was the last time you saw a movie like that, you know? Like, it's very unusual to have, like, a female at the center of it that is not that likable, that no one believes as well, you know? And that she doesn't have to have... You know, she doesn't got children. She's not married. She's got a dysfunctional relationship, but it's, and she lives with, you know, Cher is great in this movie, by the way. So I think when you, it's a very good reminder of how, again, she is a person in this film who is suffering from something that is, I mean, that just the way that buzzer goes off and the way Meryl Streep sinks down the wall, whether that was in the script or direction, you know, it's always, in, they gave her enough to even consider doing that. And the big Hollywood version of that would be a lot bigger. It's such a quiet scene, and yet it's the moment where everything changes in that film.
All right, so Tess, you picked our next scene, which is the short and really beautiful scene from Julie and Julia.
Dorothy is pregnant. Oh, isn't that wonderful?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'm so happy.
I know.
So what can we learn from, like, because this is a really short scene, but it takes us, like, across this whole range of emotion. And what we're just also hearing is that it's not overplayed by any means. So we get all of this stuff with, like, a minimum of effort, seemingly, which, of course, means that there's an incredible amount of effort involved with it. What can we learn from this scene about storytelling?
Sometimes less is more.
Yeah, and I imagine, I don't know what about you, but when you would write the first version of this scene, which would have all the information, you know, and then you'd be like, oh, that's a little bit on the nose. And then you'd write the second version and be like, still a little bit too much. And then finally you'd be like, oh my God, all I need to do is have her open a letter and say her sister is pregnant and then a hug. You know, like, that's how I would like to think she got to it. And that's a really good way to sometimes work as a writer, to just write the most obvious thing at first, because to get to the subtext immediately is you know, a hard task.
And I think her husband is doing a lot of the heavy lifting there by just getting her, not asking questions.
Exactly.
Not having to press her for information. Just know, like, what does it say about their relationship that he doesn't have to say anything? He's there... the hug is
enough.
What she wants, and he knows to give it to her, and that's the marriage, and it says it all.
Yeah.
So Tess, you picked a scene for us from Sleepless in Seattle, and we were talking earlier about Efren's gift for writing Best Friends.
Christmas Eve, he phones in one of those radio call-in shows, tells them, "I need a new wife."
Oh, you're kidding! That's so sweet.
Now he's obsessed with this one woman who wrote me.
Are you serious?
Yeah, she wants to meet me at the top of the Empire State Building.
On Valentine's Day.
Oh, it's like that movie.
What movie?
An Affair to Remember. Did you ever see it? Oh, God. Cary Grant and Deborah Carr. Is it Carr or Kerr?
Kerr.
Yeah, I picked this one because I love Rita Wilson. And I also love the dynamic, I'll talk a bit more afterwards about the male-female dynamic within this scene. But what Nora did so brilliantly was write those best friend characters that sometimes we're dismissive of, but we really shouldn't be, because they are the very makeup of the romantic comedy as well, for main characters to defer to give us opinions on stuff. So I picked this because I thought we need to remember that it's not just about the two leads in her movies. What you forget about her is that she was doing... Tarantino before Tarantino was doing Tarantino. Yeah, like how often, you know, do you hold on a character doing a monologuing like that? Yeah. It's fantastic.
And it's a bit of an information dump. It's like the best way to do that. Not everybody is going to know that movie.
Exactly.
So how do you get it across? And there's no more entertaining way than
that. And
it's
that fusion of script and performance there as well, because she really, you know, gets it right.
And, of course, it's laying a breadcrumb for us for the end of the film.
Yes.
You know, because now all of a sudden we've got a model for what might happen if they go to the Empire State Building, particularly if they don't, like, find her right away. It's like, you know, well, you know, this has happened before. Mm-hmm. There's still a possibility for hope. What does she do in writing the Rita Wilson character that's interesting? I mean, what about her besides just this, you know, wonderful monologue?
I was just going to say, it seems like a big commentary on gender, too.
Yes.
And the way in which a movie like that, a romance, of which Sleep in Seattle obviously is, will be received by men and women. And the boys are on one side, and they're like, what is going on?
And you're
on
our side.
And then, yeah, the girls are on the other side.
I think, yeah, and it it manages to, by putting the men listening to her and not giving them lines, again, very Nora, let's not let the men speak, let's just let the ladies. I think that their reaction tells us so much. It's also, we know that Tom Hanks is romantic, guys. Like, we know he is. So underneath it all, he's battling this cynicism and this bereavement and everything that's going on with him. So just them sitting there listening to her, and again, like Scott says, it's also giving a story. It's giving us, like, the ending. It's telling us what might happen. And then bringing the son in as well.
So I wonder if we could talk a little bit about something like Sleepless in Seattle or When Harry Met Sally, and talk about structure and what Nora might have to teach us about the second act and how to get from this great beginning and the meet cute and whatever to the great moment on the skyscraper at the end. How do we keep the audience's interest while at the same time, you know, putting up the stop sign and going, hey, there's more stuff that has to happen?
I mean, she was the master of the midpoint. So I think a good example of her greatest midpoint is the orgasm scene, because it's a metaphorical turning point. It's not a huge, big, dramatic scene. What it is it's the first time that Harry sees Sally in a sexual way.
What are you saying, that they fake orgasm?
It's possible.
Get out of here.
Why? Most women at one time or another have faked it.
Well, they haven't faked it with me.
How do you know?
Because I'm...
Oh. Right. That's right. I forgot. You're a man.
What is that supposed to mean?
Nothing. It's just that all men are sure it never happened to them, and most women at one time or another have done it, so you do the math.
You don't think that I could tell a difference?
No.
Get out of here.
So we don't really know, like, you know, we don't know quite what's going on. And obviously the famous story is that it was actually Meg that said, why don't I actually do the orgasm? Originally it was scripted as just her talking about it. And then further to that, the famous I'll have what she's having was actually Rob Wright, you know, like Billy Crystal's line rather. So I love it for turning the story in a totally different direction, but not in a huge plot-driven way. Because we're often told you have to have these huge, you know, devices that occur in the second act that send the story in the opposite direction. And in the romantic comedy, what you need is an emotional different direction. So I think the orgasm scene is the perfect example of that.
I can't add to that. Well said.
Thanks, Scott.
So this is the one from Heartburn. This is the dinner table conversation.
It's not a perfect movie, Heartburn, and I believe that Nora would say that herself. It's a very, very complicated personal movie about something that actually happened to her. Mm-hmm. And even Carl Bernstein, her husband, her ex-husband, who the Jack Nicholson character is based on, he made her put in a contractual agreement that he could never be portrayed as a bad father. That was the thing. He said, you can only write this movie if I don't come across as a bad dad in it. I can come across as a conniving, philandering, whatever, but I can't come across as a bad dad. So this movie is too long and has long set pieces that you're like, what is going on? But I think it's brilliant. Mm-hmm. It is raw and emotional, and this scene is towards the end of the movie, and just to set it up for you, actually, no, let's just watch it. They'll get it. They're adults.
You sort of notice that things are not the way they were, but it's a distant bell. And then when things do turn out to have been wrong, it's not that you knew all along. It was just that you were somewhere else.
I mean, you'd have to be living in a dream.
Yes. Yes.
And then the dream dies.
and the dream breaks into a million tiny little pieces, which leaves you with a choice. You can either stick with it, which is unbearable, or you can just go off and dream another dream.
I like to use the, you know, like if you show a gun, it better go off. I like to use the custard pie. If you show a custard pie, someone better get it in the face by the end of the scene. But again, it poses a question that is seemingly not really, you're like, what? Oh, they're just having a conversation about the fact that how can you not know if someone's having an affair? But as an audience, and we know that she knows. So we are sitting there uncomfortably with them through the entire scene, knowing fully well that he has been cheating on her and she knows this. And just that turn of suddenly the central question posed at her, and she goes and gets the pie, then she goes, sits back down again, then gets back up again, and it manages to be funny, and yet it's a heartbreaking scene. And yeah, I just think it's a messy, imperfect, brilliant movie.
It's the longest we've ever been on Jack Nicholson's back.
Yes.
Like, I was watching it again, being like, oh my God.
Man listening.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So we've got the first part of the ending of When Harry Met Sally.
I've been doing a lot of thinking. The thing is, I love you.
What?
I love you.
How do you expect me to respond to this?
How about you love me too?
How about I'm leaving?
I mean, it's perfect. It's, again, everything a romantic comedy ending needs to be. It's classical, but it sort of pulls the rug out. It does things, it zigs where other things zag. And what really I want to talk about is the last line. When I saw it when I was 12, it didn't even register in the way that it does now that I'm married. And it's a very classical setup. You know, it's New Year's Eve, he's running, the music is playing, she's in a gown. And the scene starts where most of them end, which is he gets to finally say, I love you. Mm-hmm. And then he goes right back to talking about Auld Lang Syne and what does it mean and all that stuff. And he's the guy he was in the beginning. And she, what does the song mean? She doesn't really know, but she's like, it has something to do with old friends. And the last line of this movie is friends. And in a romantic scene, that's not a word you hear often. But when I was watching it again, I realized kind of like, you leave the theater with such confidence that that relationship is going to work.
What can we learn from Nora about satisfying our audiences and satisfying ourselves as storytellers that we can maybe carry away?
I think when it comes to the complications of any relationship, it's about the unexpected payoff as well, which is hugely romantic in itself.
Weber and I always talk about happy sad. If anything is like too happy, it's unrealistic. But if anything's too sad, that's also just unpleasant, and who wants that? A lot of the stuff that we've seen here that she was doing was like, even the happiest things have this undercurrent of bittersweet, which is truth, which is pain, which is like, even the happily ever after is, you just sort of know the real version of that is going to include some hurt.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, and Texas Library and Archives Commission. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate for the National Endowment for the Humanities. The show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan. Our associate producers are Colin Heyer, Sonia McCarter, and Maya Perez. Our editors are Jamal Knox and Travis Neely. Music by Brian Ramos. Production assistance comes from the Sound Lab, Inc. and KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about Austin Film Festival and Conference each October. Until next time, I'm Barbara Morgan, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.
PRI, Public Radio International.